MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Special thanks to WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland. This is our KBOO Fights Back campaign. KBOO knows the importance of community media when we need it most. Help us reach our goal of $75,000 by December 31st. Join KBOO Community Radio for an in-person meet and greet at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Stop by KBOO on Saturday, December 6th or Sunday, December 7th from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Meet radio hosts and producers, members of the board of directors, and fellow KBOO community members. Enjoy coffee or tea and light refreshments, take a tour of the station, and make your year-end donation in person. For more information about KBOO Fights Back in-person events, visit kboo.fm/in-person2025. Thank you for supporting KBOO Community Radio.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industry's Child Care for Construction in partnership with Business Oregon, working to support those caring for children of journey workers in Oregon, even family and friends. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. On today's show, we devote the entire hour to Myanmar and the revolution against the brutal military dictatorship there, led by four amazing artists. Their struggle is captured in a stunning documentary by filmmaker Jeannie Hallisey entitled Thabiye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar, which is making its premiere in the San Francisco Bay Area on Sunday, November 30th at the San Francisco Main Library. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with that and more here on Flashpoints. From United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the ASEAN conference just last month, where he addresses the terrible situation now facing the people of Myanmar.
I am appalled by the deplorable situation in Myanmar. The military takeover in 2021 has piled calamity upon calamity. Villages bombed or burned, thousands killed, millions displaced, regional stability at risk, a military attacking the civilians it's meant to protect, and now the specter of elections within an active conflict. The atrocities and the cycle of impunity must end.
and welcome to another edition of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Kevin Pina. Well, today we have a real special program. We're going to be moving our attention to Burma, which is now known as Myanmar, and a wonderful documentary film that's going to be arriving here in the Bay Area and showing Sunday, November the 30th at the San Francisco Library. I'll give more details about that toward the end of our program, but we're going to devote the entire hour to understanding Myanmar. We know that this is a decades-old struggle, but this film, which is called Thabye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar, is really visual poetry and a love story to four Burmese artists who are leading, in various ways, resistance to the current military regime in that country. It is a horrible situation, but this is a film that is so inspiring with hope and capturing their love for their country and how each in their own way, through their own art and activism, are contributing toward the freedom of people in Myanmar. Later in the program, we're going to speak with the filmmaker Jeannie Halasi. Jeannie is an interesting soul. She's lived and worked in Southeast Asia for over three decades. She's directed award-winning documentary films about human rights and social justice issues. Also joining us, my pleasure to have on this show, Tat Swe Win. He is one of the four artists that are in the film, that are featured in the film. He is the artivist. Incredible work that Tat has been doing on the border between Thailand and Myanmar. Folks need to know, and I'm sure that our guests are going to give you more of these statistics, but one that just really blew my mind was 3.5 million people displaced through this horrible situation. I want to start with you, Tat. If we can, you know, Burma was a former British colony. It received its independence in 1948. And I don't think many of our listeners understand sort of that history, you know, goes forward up to where we are today.
All right, thank you. For the Burma history, it is like, you know, we got independence in 1948. And yeah, since the independence, the revolution also started together with the independence because like Burma, we have like more than 100 ethnicities and many big and small ethnicities that we got to unify all the ethnicities together with one agreement called Penang Agreement. And then through that agreement, then we built an independent nation. And basically Burma, we have a flat land and also we have a highland. So like all those like periphery area or the highland area, they got, you know, they were autonomous regime, you know, before the English colonial time. And then when some of the area, they were also independent, even under the English colonial regime. So, but when we about to get the independence, that we, the Burmese leader, the father of a Nobel Peace Laureate, Aung San Suu Kyi, called General Aung San, who was the founding father of the country. So he tried, he and other colleagues tried to unify the country with all the diverse groups together. But before we get the independence in 1948, in 1947, General Aung San Suu Kyi's father, who got been assassinated by his rival group, and the political situation was a little bit quite chaotic. And but you know the other leaders could make the independent agreement with the British, but that kind of agreement wasn't really digest among the other ethnic groups. So even after the just like, you know, right after the independence, then we got a the M revolution by ethnic Karen groups. So the revolution is born together with our independence. That is the bitter history about Burma.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest today, Tat Swe Win. He is an artivist who is on the border with Myanmar and Thailand. We're talking about the history of Myanmar. Tat, you can go ahead and continue.
Since then, the ethnic minorities, ethnic groups are fighting for their own rights and also for their own autonomy. But the successive government, the central government, always portrayed those revolutions as a rebel group, that ethnic minorities are doing bad things. They are the ones who try to destroy the nation or union. This is how that all the governments been portrayed to the revolution.
So they demonize them as rebel groups, labeling them.
Sorry?
They demonize them, labeling them rebel groups.
Yes, yes, this is what they do, what they did. The ethnic minorities are actually looking for their own independence. Independence means like their self-determination. That is important. And they are also asking for the federal democratic nation up to the date. And their goal is like not to separate from the country, but to have equality among other ethnicities. So that is what they have strived for. But in Myanmar, since the independence, we were born with the civil war, and also we have the hierarchy system by the ethnicities or race or religion. For example, the Bamar ethnic, the Burmans, we are the majority ethnic in the whole country. But as I said, we have more than 100 ethnicities in the country. So more than 100 ethnicities and many diverse religions as well. Our society is like kind of a pyramid society. The Burmese Buddhist people are the top of the society. After that, Burmese Christian or Burmese Hindu or Muslims. And then like non-Burmese ethnic groups are also, you know, enter that. And at the same time, not only, even after the independence, not only the M revolution emerged, but also a lot of public movements and revolution, the public revolution started. So we have in 1952, you know, that there was a big student movement in the capital city, Yangon. Then, you know, all of the students were gathered in one of the union buildings in the biggest university in Myanmar, the Yangon University. Then, but at that time, the military regime, they planted a bomb at that university, the student union, and they exploded it. So hundreds of students died. Wow. And also like in the 1988, the nationwide people's movement happened that demanded for the democracy, because like things like from the 1948 up to 1950-something, we only have about like 10 years time of parliament democracy. But after that, we got a 1952, we got a military regime again, military coup again. Then since then, that country got under the military regime, and then until the 2010. So many, you know, like generation of the military generals have been ruling the country. At the same time, as I said, the people movement happened everywhere. And majorly, like one in the student movement in 1952, after that, in 1988, that nationwide student movement calling for the democracy and freedom, and also to make the regime change back in the time. Then Burma was also under the socialism after the, you know, that when we got independent from 1948 up to the 1950-something, we were under the parliament democracy. After that, we got into the military regime, and that military regime, that general, he tried to change the system into the socialist, the multi-party socialism system.
So it was a progressive military regime at that point.
It was a state military regime, but they did change the political system into that socialism system, and very much centralized. And since that time, you know, the country got stalled. All the developments got stopped, and all the developments got stalled. Because from the, you know, until the military coup back in the time, Burma was very a very promising country in Southeast Asia. And we were one of the best in the whole Southeast Asia as well. And a lot of, like, you know, educated people, and we were like a one of the leading nations in Southeast Asia. But after the military regime, so they closed all the doors, they shut down communication with the international community, and also the military forced all the curriculums, the higher education curriculums, such as university education, into, they changed everything into Burmese. Because we were inherited the English, you know, education, and also many of the British, you know, educational and their systems is already in place there.
And let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of my guest, Tet Swe Win. We're talking to him on the Myanmar-Thai border. I think, Tet, you were talking about General Ne Win, the so-called socialist general in Burma, who took over in 1962 and was in power until 1998.
He was an educated person. So he did not want, you know, those English-speaking people, or like he became like very racist. So he just like kicked out, you know, all the English teachers or like English-speaking people, and also Chinese and Indian people. He kicked everyone out of the country, and most of the educated people and the wealthy people are already leaving the country. Mm. Because that military regime, that socialist regime, they even confiscated people's properties. So many of the businesses were confiscated by the government back in the time. They didn't even know how to do the business.
We're sort of going over the history of Burma from its independence to how we got here today. Just really quick, Tet. So 1962, there's a revolutionary council, and they introduced what was called the Burmese way to socialism. And it's also called coupon socialism, because they also like would allow people to purchase ownerships in companies by distributing these coupons, is that right?
Yes, correct.
It's interesting because, you know, socialist revolutions, I mean, we know that Chavez in Venezuela had a socialist revolution that was a military, that came from the military. You know, there was a military moment in Portugal where there was a progressive group of progressive officers who took over the government there, which led to a lot of freedom and independence movements in Africa, former Portuguese colonies. But you're telling us that in the Burmese context, that this socialist takeover by the military was not a good thing.
It wasn't. Yeah, they called it the Burmese way of socialism. That is what they called it. And then that is not a real socialism that they did. It was too centralized. And then
so it was sort of pseudo-socialism. They were using the word socialism, but they were really doing something else.
Yeah. So, you know, they got like, you know, the general repression in the general public. So in 1988, the students led demography movement, the biggest one ever back in the time, and then they took down the socialist regime, and also the general called that General Ne Win, who was the one of the 30 comrades who fought for the independence of Burma. Then he was actually that general back in the time who led that socialist regime, was a freedom fighter, and he was one of the 30 leaders who fought for freedom for Burma. Mm. But he became a dictator, you know, once he became the commander in chief of the military. Then he did the coup.
Right.
So that is also one remarkable thing, that the independent fighter, the hero, became villain and became dictatorship. Then that is how he dragged the country down.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that is the voice of my guest, Tet Swe Win. He's talking to us, coming to us from the border of Thailand and Myanmar. Now let's go ahead and take a short break. When we get back, we'll continue our discussion about Thab Ye, the creative resistance of Myanmar, the documentary that features Tet Swe Win, along with three other artists who are fighting the revolution there. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints.
And welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And that beautiful music was from Fosun, who is also one of the four artists who are featured in this incredible documentary, Thabye, which is going to be premiering again November the 30th in San Francisco. I'll give you the information later. I'm talking with Tetsue Win about the Burmese Myanmar military. We're talking about General Ne Win, Tet.
It was the first generation of the Burmese military regime, and the second generation of the military regime started in 1989 and 1980. That the another new general called General Tan Shui, he became the chief of the military, and then they felt like, you know, they're gonna.
So just a second, Tet. So we've got this huge demonstration that overthrows Ne Win, and then we have a new general, Tan Shui, who takes power in 1989.
Because in the 1988 uprising, it was a very big one that the people demanding for the, you know, for the for a change and for the democracy. But the military, you know, they took over power again from the previous socialist government. The military took over power. And in fact, they were due that elections in, you know, 2-3 years. After they got power, they said, oh, we do not have the proper constitutions yet. Mm. So let's draw the constitution again. And it took about 20 more years again, from 1990 up to 2010. Like 20 years it took.
But there
we will end up the military regime again.
And it seems like there was this sort of back and forth between power, right? Testing of power between them and military dictatorships. What about the Buddhist monks in Myanmar? When did they become part of the movement to overthrow the dictatorship?
The Buddhist monks protest was in 2007.
Right, but they were part of 1988 as well, right? That was the first time that they really started to show up.
There were some Buddhist monks involved in the 1988 effort, yeah.
And so then, of course, the Saffron Revolution, as it's known, in 2007, was really led by those Buddhist monks, and they were horribly repressed. Talk to us about what led up to that period. And I remember seeing those horrific images of Buddhist monks in their robes, their bodies floating down the river, having been murdered by the military.
So in the 2007 Saffron Revolution, I personally participated in that revolution. So it was the early stage of my activism life. I finished my university. I graduated in 2005 especially. So I was still like connected to the universities. Mm. And then also the thing happened, because it started in one town in the central Burma, that, you know, that the military beat it. They tortured a Buddhist man. They tied the Buddhist man in an electric pole. And they tortured the Buddhist man. That information went viral. And also the demand of the Buddhist man at the time was about the increasing of the fuel price. So that the demand were very simple. The first of the demands were not about any of the political demands. It was just about the economic crisis.
Cost of living.
The Buddhist
The cost of living and price of diesel gas and natural gas.
Yes.
And then later that would develop, though, into more
political demands, mm-hmm. later. And then more and more lay people, and including the student leaders, joined the movement. So it was just started by the Buddhist monks, and, you know, men, the Buddhist monks around the country just, you know, walk outside together and chanting the Dhamma and talking about beef, and, you know, going around, you know, the feedies and just doing the chanting stuff. But, you know, about a week after, then the student leaders joined the movement together, and it became more political. After that, the general public joined the movement as well, and it became bigger and bigger, and became a nationwide movement.
And that became a threat to the military regime, right?
Like oppressed and destroyed by the military. That when Nung Kiv was about the mascara of the murder case of a Japanese journalist back in the time, that one Japanese journalist was killed by the Burmese military. It has been framed by some of the video journalists, the underground video journalists, as Filipino journalists, of the media. So it has been captured how the Burmese military killed the person. And also many of the Buddhist monks were tortured and killed, and many were arrested and imprisoned for many years. But it ended up, it would happen in 2007. It was kind of a booster to make the military regime change. Then after the 2007 regime, 2007 revolution, in 2008, there was a big cyclone hit to Burma, like the worst cyclones in our history. Then like hundreds of thousands of people died by the lack of the information about the incoming cyclone. That military regime, they did not let people know about the cyclone is coming in, because they are planning to hold a referendum for their newly written constitution, the 2008 constitution that we know, that the current constitution of the country that been using until 2021. So like the military, they did not let people know, and they just kept quiet, and a lot of people died. But even like 2-3 months after that disaster, the military did the referendum everywhere, including the seriously hit area. And even many of the dead people's name were in the voting list. They said, majority of the people voted this constitution. It was in 2008, and in 2010, according to that constitution, that military kept calling for the elections. Mm-hmm. to change the regime. And in 2010, that we got elections, and then the first ever quasi government, that the military general who changed their uniform into plain clothes became a power, got the president Deng Xing. He was a former general as well. But back in the time that the opposition party, Aung San Suu Kyi, so she was still under the house arrest until the first elections, until the 2012. So she was under the house arrest.
Her party was the NLD, the National League for Democracy.
NLD is like National League for Democracy. That party, the political parties that appeared in the 1988 movement, that party is led by the Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate, and also the daughter of our founding father, mm-hmm. General Aung San. And she served as a state counselor from 2015 to until 2021 coup. And right now she is currently at the house arrest with many charges.
And just to remind our listeners, in case you forgot, you're listening to Flashpoints. And that's the voice of our guest, Tetsuwei Nguyen. He is one of four amazing artists who were featured in a documentary called Thab Ye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar. Later in the program, we're going to be joined by Jeannie Hallisey, who's the director of the film. So stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints. And that was Fo San. He's also one of the four artists who are featured in the documentary film Thab Ye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar. Tet, I want to continue this conversation about Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy Party. Many of the movements and resistance against the military regime also sort of lost a little faith in the NLD, that the National League for Democracy, that they didn't see them, that when they were in power, there was some question about the role that they were playing with the military. Is that true?
True, including me, that because everyone hope that because Aung San Suu Kyi got the Nobel Peace Award while she was under house arrest. So, but everyone, including the international global leaders, see her as a democracy and human rights icon.
Yes.
But when she released from the house arrest, when she got into the power position as a state counselor, as the highest position, she declared herself as a person above the president. She stood up for the military. Mm. That is also another, you know, tricky part of the story, you know, about, you know, about the Burma, you know, the development for the democracy.
Right, because Aung San Suu Kyi is seen as this sort of revered figure, you know, being the daughter of the leader of independence, General Aung San, and then, of course, the role that she played in the democracy movement. And then suddenly you see her getting closer and cozier with the military, and then a lot of people who are her supporters become a little more disillusioned with her and the NLD.
Yeah, because of the Rohingya genocide in 2000, the Rohingya ethnicity, they are the most oppressed minority ethnicity, the Muslim minority community in Burma and in the Rakhine State.
Why?
And the Burmese military, they are the Islamophobic, and they kept, you know, targeting the Muslim communities every chance they have. And the Muslims over there, the Rohingya people over there, are the most targeted community, the ethnic community. And so military has been dehumanizing, degrading the status of the Rohingya ethnicities since 1970s. You know, since they did the very first coup back in the time, that they started targeting the Muslim communities. And that the Rohingya's identities were like degraded, you know, from the like ethnicity to the nation of to the citizenship, and then all the citizenship rights were stripped off and became kind of like, you know, white card, which have kind of a temporary stay permit and etc. So, and then later they took out all the identity of the Rohingya people, and in 2012 that military started ethnic cleansings and genocide against the Rohingya people. Since in 2012, that is also one time bomb that Burmese military planted, that thinks Aung San Suu Kyi is running for the elections, thinks NLD, her party, is running for the elections. It was a systematic time bomb that military planted, you know, to make problems for the future government when the Aung San Suu Kyi became in the power position. So that is also one tricky part of them. But Aung San Suu Kyi, we all thought that, you know, she, as a human rights champion, that, you know, we all hoped that she might, you know, do something for the oppressed people and underprivileged people. But for the Rohingya community and the Rohingya genocide, she just ignored them. She did not recognize Rohingya as an ethnicity, and she did not, you know, recognize the genocide. Then she just, instead of, you know, protecting them, protecting the oppressed people, they are, she's like protecting the oppressor. She's protecting the military, the perpetrator. And she even
defending
stood up for the military and defending for them in the International Court of Justice. So, you know, everyone got shocked that what we did not expect, that, you know, herself or her party will be that kind of, you know, a point of view towards the ethnic minorities. Not only on that case, but also with the other ethnic minorities as well, that they see the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi, they still see them as the subordinate, you know, citizenship or subordinate ethnicities, so which wasn't acceptable for us as a human rights defenders. So I did a lot of, like, you know, public movements and public speeches that wasn't a right thing as a government to be done, you know, to discriminate the minorities and to discriminate other ethnic cities. So, you know, I've been targeted by both military and the government between 2016 and 2021.
Well, let me remind our listeners.
Or both in the government.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that is the voice of our guest, Tetsue Nguyen. He is speaking to us from the border of Myanmar, and we're talking about the history of the country from Burmese independence in 1948 all the way. We're all the way now to 2000. We're almost at the 2021 coup, right? This is where Now we see the military just outright take over again in 2021.
Yes.
Why don't you get so how do we so we go from Aung San Suu Kyi and we have this disillusionment with her. We have severe repression of the Rohingya community. She is defending the military, and then her government's overthrown.
Yeah, by the military that she defended for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Irony of ironies, yeah.
So in 2021, because, like, you know, I did not participate in the 2020 elections. I openly opposed that election because, like, the government, the NLD government back in the time, they used the COVID-19 as an opportunity to win the elections. That is what I saw. And, you know, they did not let, they did not have the elections in many ethnic areas by the reason of the COVID-19 and also the instabilities of that areas by the civil war, by the fighting with the ethnic militaries. So,
But you didn't help us to understand. How did that start occurring? When did that start occurring? The armed resistance in the countryside, and, you know, had that always been there? That sort of brutality of the military, and then people defending themselves.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, that, you know, the armed revolution started together with our independence. It has been there, you know, until now, for more than five, six decades already. So many of the ethnic armed resistance organizations, ethnic revolutionary organizations, we are still there, and they are still fighting. Even though the regime changed in the central government, that even though, you know, we face like so-called democracy for 10 years from 2010 to 20, ethnic area still got fighting every day. Mm. And ethnic people have still got running. So, and the military is like propaganda to the people in the city, saying that, oh, these rebels are very bad. We have to stop them. They lied to the people in the city, and the people in the city did not know what causes about the ethnic revolutions. So they just like blindly, you know, followed what the military portrayed. And the military, they use the race and religion card every time. They felt like they are the guardian of the Buddhism and protector of the Burma ethnic city. So that is what they always portray, and then they make the Burma and Buddhist people see that we are a threat by the non-Burma, non-Buddhist people. So we have to protect them. There is only one institution that can protect the Burma Buddhist community, which is the military.
Sort of very, very, very similar to what we see going on in India today with its current leadership, right?
Yeah.
With the between Hindus, yeah. Right, and non-Hindus. Interesting. It's also a way of keeping people divided. But then, of course, you had this movement that emerged in the cities that was brutally repressed. And there's activists like yourself. You call yourself an artivist, but primarily a political activist. And you then are working for unity with those same ethnic communities that had been under fire from the successive military regimes in the countryside.
Yes, yes.
So how is that going? I mean, that could not have been easy. I mean, to sit down because of the propaganda, the military, and the circumstances of that continuing war, and then suddenly the Burman people in the capital, which you represent, suddenly are sitting down and talking to people like the Rohingya and trying to build coalition into a single movement.
Actually, that wasn't easy. Like, I started my activism, you know, in 2010. And I got involved in the anti-hate movement towards the Muslim minorities in 2012. After I see a lot of hate crimes, hate movements by the nationalist groups, I saw that is the threat of the demography, and that is the threat for the future nation that we imagine for. The people just, like, you know, blindly believe, you know, what the military is doing for. But for me, like, you know, I was so lucky by myself that, like, you know, I did not, I'm not a person who easily believes whatever. So I always, like, want to, you know more. I want to curious about it. When I see things that is, you know, that it wasn't right, then I started, you know, making out about it, you know, talking out loud about it. also with the Rohingya issue, like I did not understand, I did not know about the Rohingya until 2012, because we only had about the name Rohingya together as a boat people. But I started to try to understand about the Rohingya issue, and then once I learned about it, so I knew that, you know, I have to work for them in the Burma Buddhist dominant community, like in Yangon, the major city, that, you know, it was a very challenging for us to talk about it, because many of the people are the racist. I mean, they don't want to be racist. They don't know that they are racist, because, you know, this is how we raised to become, you know, by the institutions, by the system. So it was quite a challenge for me to speak out about it. And I also got life threat, you know, by some of the nationalist groups, and also transferred that to my
death threats,
or
the
organizations. Yeah.
So it's clear you really fought hard against this racism. And, you know, the Rohingya, of course, are well known for being repressed in China as well. And I know that China is also involved in Myanmar. Let's talk about the role of China.
China is everywhere now in Burma. China, Russia, India, they are the hardcore supporters. And China, they think before the coup, they started building a casino city at the Thai Myanmar border next to Miaori. It's called Shikoku and KK Park, and it's like a big casino compound, a big casino.
A casino.
But yeah, they call it casino, but later it ended up as a scamming center. So it became that area became the global scamming hub, the base in the Thai Myanmar border, especially in the Burma side. And that is run by the Chinese syndicates. The Chinese mafia are there. They do a lot of, you know, like bad things, including human trafficking, organ trading, you know, the scamming, and many other bad things that are done by all those mafia groups over there. And also, the Chinese businesses are coming in, especially to the conflict area in Karini, Kachin, Shan, all the borderline area with China. All the Chinese business that came in, and they are doing a lot of extractions of the minerals, like, for example, antimony, rare earth minerals, tin, tungsten, everything. All the natural resources of Burma were taken by the Chinese in 5 years of the military regime. They see it as an opportunity, and then because the conflict is there, we need, you know, money to buy ammunition and stuff, and then we have to sell whatever we have, and then they got a like very cheap deal, and they're getting all the, you know, the resources from us cheaply. And also they're dealing not only with the ethnic revolutionary groups, but they also deal with the government, the military regime, inside the country, and doing a lot of, you know, real estate and other investments to get benefit out of the conflict of Burma.
So the Chinese government plays an outsized role in the struggle then, in terms of keeping this military dictatorship in power.
Yeah, and China, they don't really supporting the revolution. They are only dealing with the revolutionaries, like, you know, just for the business. And for example, they even, you know, give a lot of pressure to the ethnic revolutionary groups to stop fighting against the Burmese military. So China is playing very hugely influential for the ethnic revolution group in Burma, and also to the Burmese military.
So let's kind of move to 2021, and because in this film, Thaap Yai, Creative Resistance in Myanmar, there is a sense of unity now that did not exist before. And let's just talk about that now. Is that portrayal of unity a genuine? Is that actually what's happening now? You're seeing these disparate forces, including the minorities now, beginning to cooperate together to resist the Myanmar military regime.
But that revolution, that 2021 situation, was a biggest change for the young people, because since before the coup, as I said, you know, I did not participate in the vote because I saw no chance of democracy under that, even under the NLD regime, because NLD was taking fight with the military and NLD was defending for the military. I felt really hopeless, so I did not even participate in the elections. I got hopeless. But this revolution unite people again, especially unite young people again, because young people who are in the revolution right now, they are the ones who have tasted the a little bit of the taste of the freedom for 10 years, from 2010 to 2020. So they grew up in this time. So they know how the freedom tastes like. So they want to get the freedoms that they used to get. So that is the biggest motive of the young people to fight back. And then that is the motive for them to be united. Of course, like after 5 years, we still have a lot of frictions, we still have a lot of flaws, but we are still on the right direction towards our goal, and we are still going to that direction, even though we are slow.
Well, I've got one last question specifically for you, Tet, before.
Yeah.
And by the way, so much respect. I know that you've had death threats. I know that you've fought this fight a long time and risking yourself and risking your family and being separated from your family at times. Tet, one of the things that is I want to try to also understand is the young men in the military. And so I wonder, what is the indoctrination that these young men must go through in the Myanmar military in order to commit the atrocities that they're committing, that they've been committing against people who've been resisting military rule?
You mean the Burmese young people who've been conscripted to
yes.
the military and
yes.
then what they're doing it? That is strange. Actually, you know, the majority of the people of the Burma ethnic people who are fighting against the Burmese military, especially the Central Burma, they are the ones, they are actually from the Central Burma area. They, that area, all those who are fighting against right now, they are the major recruitment population for the Burmese military. But, you know, instead of joining the Burmese military, young people are joining the resistance forces and fighting back. But some of the young people are still joining the military because they were forced or they were conscripted or, you know, or their family need some cash because like, they get some cash when they, you know, kind of sell their, you know, children to the military kind of thing.
Yeah, that's an old story. The kids of poor families whose only choice is to join the military in order to stay alive.
It looks like, you know, many reasons. But what I can see is that even no matter what reason you join the Burmese military for, but majority of the young people who got into the military, they became like one of them. That is strange. Their indoctrination is really, really powerful. Like, you know, we got to, you know, brainwash them again, because like even after they conscripted and even you know, some young people, some of them already switched sides to the revolution, even after they conscripted, after they sent to the front line to fight, they did not want to fight, and they first fight with the revolution. The revolution fight have a strategy, have a mechanism to to feather them down. Like we keep them for like 3 to 6 months to see how they are feeling is and how their reactions are. That only once we see that they are stable and they are psychologically okay, we let them try with the resistance forces that fight back the Burmese military.
Interesting. Well, listen, I want to bring Jeannie in here now to talk a little bit about the film which you are portrayed in. Again, that was the voice of Tet Sway Nguyen. He is one of the artists. He's an artivist. Amazing work that you do. We're going to come back and let you describe that for our listeners as well. But I want to turn to you, Jeannie Hallisey, and I want to talk about let's just do a brief sort of recounting of who these four individuals are that are profiled in this documentary, this beautiful documentary.
Thanks so much, Kevin and KPFA, for giving us this platform. Really appreciate it. I feel like Burma, Myanmar is one of the worst conflict situations and humanitarian crises in the world that has been grossly ignored and overshadowed by the many conflicts that are currently sweeping our unstable, tumultuous world. The BA Creative Resistance in Myanmar is a portrait of four different individuals, who all of whom have a creative practice that they were doing prior to the Myanmar military coup in 2021. And all of them continue their activism as leaders in the revolution whilst they're still doing their art and using their art to leverage that as a voice for those who cannot be seen or heard, because most of the people that you've been describing, that Tet Swe Win mentioned, are people who cannot be reached by international media. And even for Myanmar media, it's extremely dangerous. So there's incredible Myanmar journalists and citizen journalists who are risking their lives to go into the frontline areas in the midst of the conflict to document these millions and millions of people who are displaced by this ongoing uprising against the military. So the four people who we portrayed include Susanna Lalasso, and she is a painter. She was a painter long before she joined the parliament with Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy. She was elected as a parliamentarian. And she happens to be an ethnic Karen woman, one of the groups that Tet Swe Win mentioned. Myanmar has over 135 ethnic nationalities, and 15 of them are the biggest, the largest group. One of them is the Karen, and she happens to be a Karen woman leader. And she was an activist for most of her life, particularly focused on women's issues. And when the space opened up for democratic elections for the first time in over half a century, she was persuaded to run and became a parliamentarian. But she's a painter. The other one is Tet Swe Win, who you've been speaking with, who, although he's not, he does do some poetry, but he's not a practicing artist as such, but he's what we call an artivist, using the incredible array of talent of artists in this revolution, performing and visual artists who are using their gifts to try to amplify the voices of people from Myanmar. So Tet Swe Win organizes exhibitions, performance art, brings together artists and spaces as a way to give them a conduit to share their work. The third protagonist is someone who is become a very interesting character in this revolution, Mong Song Ka. He was he is a beloved poet, and was actually arrested several times before the military coup because, in addition to being a poet, he was an activist and had his own NGO, non-governmental organization, in Myanmar called Athan, which means expression in English. And he was an advocate for freedom of expression, particularly for writers, both journalistic writers as well as creative writers, and was imprisoned several times, one time of which was simply for a poem that he wrote and posted, a line of a poem that he posted on Facebook, and was imprisoned for that. But he was someone who was very involved in also bringing together the different ethnic nationalities, which Tet has referred to, during the great outpouring of what was millions of people came out in the streets after the Myanmar military coup in February 2021. And this was the first time in all of these seven decades of struggles and multiple attempts at revolution against military rule that we saw the entire country came out. Every major city, from the northern city of Mandalay to Rangoon or Yangon, as it's called now, towns, villages, everywhere across the country. But he felt it was extremely important to make sure that the voices of ethnic nationalities were part of this uprising that was now being led, mostly because, as Tet Swe Win explained, the Bama or Burmese majority were the ones who were initially fueling this response of protest, but he wanted to be front and center to make sure that the ethnic voices were heard. And he took a leadership role in the streets of Rangoon and was part of this ethnic nationalities coordinating committee. at one particular time during a protest that he led that was mostly followed by youth, there was a brutal crackdown because the protests that followed after the coup were short-lived. They began as an almost celebratory party-like atmosphere, also very creative and very vibrant, where we had, you know, there were punk rockers taking the streets with purple spiked hair. There were young people who dressed in wedding gowns to say that they were like using the protest movement to marry themselves to freedom and democracy. There were painters doing giant street murals. There were artists performing all over, you know, musicians performing songs all over. It was in the beginning a really vibrant and beautiful uprising of creativity, if you like, against the dictatorship. But it then soon was crushed with live bullets, and people started being shot across the country. And in one such protest that he was leading, there was a brutal crackdown and several youth were killed in front of him. And that was a pivotal point for him, because Maung Suu Kyi had spent his entire life as a poet, an activist, and strong believer in nonviolence. That was something he repeated throughout his activism period. But he realized that there was no match against this force, this military force. And so he, with a small cadre of poets, fled from the city to the jungle and formed an army. And he is now the leader of the first ever Bama ethnic army, because as Tetsui Nguyen explained, in the last seven decades, the armed resistance against the military has mostly been led by ethnic armed organizations, the Karen, Kachin, Shan, Mon, you know, groups who have been fighting for their autonomy and against the systematic oppression of their culture and their history. But the Bama, who are the majority Burmans, from which the word Burma came when during the British colonial period, never had their own ethnic army. So it's quite historical what he's doing by forming this army, as saying we are just one of the ethnic groups now fighting alongside our brothers and sisters. So quite an interesting person and a real visionary. And the fourth person is an extraordinary violinist. His name is Po San, who is very, very, very gifted. I hope your listeners can come and see the film, because we do showcase a piece of his talent in the film. Po San was a violinist, a professional violinist in Yangon before the coup. He participated in different ensembles. He performed with other artists, and he also made his living giving violin lessons. And he formed a group, like some of the other artists that I explained, to resist with art. And during the early period, before they started shooting people to put the protests down, and he formed a violin group to go out on the streets and perform whilst marching in the streets, perform these violin songs. And the military identified him as the leader of this group, and he was targeted for arrest. And so he fled, and he's now in the border town of Maesot, where I'm speaking from, which is just a stone's throw across a very narrow river from Karen State in Burma, the relative safety of Thailand. So those are the four people who we portrayed, and we were trying to tell a story of Myanmar's revolution through these four people by using them as a vessel for the many, many others who are not portrayed in the film, but as symbols of those other artists like them. There are many, many painters, poets, musicians, theater artists who have joined the armed revolution because they felt there was no other choice.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest today, Jeannie Hallisey. She is the filmmaker of a film that's going to be premiering. Help me with the pronunciation here again. I think I didn't do it so well last time. Thab Ye. Creative Resistance in Myanmar. It's going to be Sunday, November the 30th. The showing begins at 1 o'clock, and it's going to be in the main library, the Corret Auditorium main library in San Francisco, 100 Larkin Street. You can probably call them 415-557-4400 for more information. Again, Thabyaye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar, Sunday, November the 30th, 1 o'clock, and the Court Auditorium Main Library, 100 Larkin Street in the city. Don't miss it. It is an extraordinary film. Jeannie Hallisey, filmmaker for Thabyaye, Creative Resistance in Myanmar. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Kevin.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of